We,
Sonia,
and Janooni are a couple of pals studying science in undergrad. We are not professionals.
Though every episode is meticulously researched, mistakes do happen.
If you notice that anything...
And we mean anything!
We state is inaccurate, please let us know.
Your comments, suggestions, and queries are important in furthering our personal and audience's understanding of science.
Thanks for being a part of this discussion.
We appreciate you.
We really do.
Bop bop. Beep it up bop.
Welcome back to another episode of Beaker Bros, where we drink out of
beakers
because we're bros. Hi guys.
Dink.
Oh,
whoop. Clink.
Clink.
There you go.
Welcome back to another episode where we will be talking about drugs. I'm kidding.
That's right. got fentanyl, methamphetamine. I can't say the word. Meth.
Advil,
some Tylenol, acetaminophen,
Tums,
the hard drugs, Tums.
You know them. You know, I know you guys snorted rockets when you were little. Don't lie. Anyways, back to drugs. Today's episode, we're going to talk about addiction.
Yes. And just a little bit about what it is, its prevalence here in Canada, and then Janooni's going to give us the lowdown on some of the neuroscience and the other aspects of it, and I will provide some lighthearted commentary that is very relevant and not...
Yes.
Anyways.
But trigger warning, like, if, again, we're going to be talking about substance abuse and addiction and drugs, so before you... continue. Just gonna give a nice little warning.
I feel like we've said the drug thing. We should have said the thing from the very beginning. But it's okay. Anyways, with that being said, let's go over some statistics here in Canada.
And what is addiction before we jump into statistics, Sonia?
Let me say that. Before we dive in, let's go over a little bit about some definitions and statistics. So to start off, according to CAMH, which is the Canadian Mental Health Association here in Canada, as it said right in the title, addiction, they define addiction as, quote, a complex process where problematic patterns of substance abuse or behaviors can interfere with a person's life. Addiction can be broadly defined as a condition that leads to a compulsive engagement with a stimuli despite negative consequences. And by this, this compulsive engagement, I guess, can lead to physical and or psychological dependence. So in Canada, addiction, let's start off with worldwide and then go to Canada. So worldwide, it is estimated that nearly 5% of the world's population has engaged in illicit substance use, with 240 million people around the world who also use alcohol problematically, and approximately 15 million people use injection drugs. So that sounds like a lot. Most likely, this is vastly underreported, specifically because, you know, a lot of people probably won't come forward to talk about this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Specifically looking at alcohol or problematic alcohol abuse, worldwide, they said 240 million people. If you think of the world's population, just to contextualize it a little bit, so that would roughly be around 1 in 30 people. So let's say you're in a class, an average class size, whether you're in high school, elementary school, university, work environment, whatever, you most likely engage with someone that has or that uses alcohol in a problematic way. But in Canada, it's actually these incidences of abuse are much higher. So it is estimated that approximately 21% or around 1 in 5 people will meet the criteria for addiction in their lifetime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and alcohol specifically was or is the most common substance for which people meet the criteria for addiction, which is 1 in 5. So if you look at the, again, going back, we were saying around 1 in 30 people worldwide mm-hmm. have, you know, the, what's it called, use alcohol problematically. Here in Canada, it's about 1 in 5.
Damn. What, well, I'm curious about, I don't know if you're going to mention this, but about the age groups in which this addiction is more prevalent.
So that's actually a good question, and I don't have the information for that here. But
that's fine. I was just going to, like, comment on the fact that, like, you know how, like, in university, alcohol is quite, like, prevalent, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, the frequency in which alcohol is being used, it could be considered an addiction. But, mm-hmm. like you were saying, like, this information could be underreported because being in university, that is a norm, like, the consumption of alcohol at that, like, mm-hmm. rate. But in kind of, like, contrast, that's kind of considered addiction. So I'm just, like, curious on, like, the stats on, like, how it was reported, like, mainly which, like, age group, but it's interesting to just an idea.
Yeah, or maybe not to the extent of addiction. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but the thing with substance use and abuse, it's defined as a spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So you could have, on one end, it being beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that, like, you had a surgery, and you use a specific opioid to suppress whatever pain that you have in a meaningful and manageable way. That mm-hmm. could come off as beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the other end of the spectrum, which is defined as chronic dependence. And yeah. then that's when you get that those addictive tendencies that yeah. cause, like I was saying before, psychological or physical harm to your body.
What I was like more like trying to say that is like, addiction prevalent in university students or like in young adults might be overlooked just because like it's the norm and be like people might think, oh, that's fine because like everyone's drinking. So mm-hmm. like if someone wakes up and like is drinking alcohol, it's like, oh no, it's fine, like that is what it is, right? But it could be
not like, your morning coffee.
Yeah,
your morning tequila.
It reminds me of like my prof back at McGill. So they were drinking coffee and they like, it was like 8:30 class. They sip it and they're like, this would be way better with Bailey's in it. I was like, sorry, that's just reminded me. But yeah, I was just thinking about like how in university students have that, like that stats could be underreported just because again, the whole norm. But mm-hmm. do you have any more stats?
I feel like that's the main part that's relevant to this conversation. So I'll end it off there.
No, that's fine. But yeah, like I was going to say before, like how you were talking about chronic dependency and stuff. Before, addiction wasn't, like it was initially thought to be a behavioral disorder, but neuroscience definitely has allowed us to understand how the brain changes to exposure to specifically substance abuse. It wasn't until like 1987 when addiction was coined as a disease by medical organizations such as the American Medical Association. And with that, scientists can now treat addiction as a disease as a result of scientific and, like, technology advancements. So I'm just saying, like, science definitely has played a part in the whole... Oh, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, no, wait, finish your thought, then I'll...
I was going to say, science definitely has played a part in helping us view addiction as an actual disease rather than, like, a behavioral disorder and treat it better.
Gotcha. Have you heard of the DSM?
Yeah.
So do you know if, like, how addiction, I guess, is categorized in the DSM?
Oh, yeah. So I remember literally taking a normal psych and they were talking about this. It's not categorized as addiction. It has a different name to it. Let me just pause for a second and look this up because I don't want to give...
Yeah, I took a mental health course in first year, mm-hmm. and I was just remembering that, and I was just thinking, maybe Janine might remember.
I think they say substance use disorder rather than addiction.
Mm-hmm.
There are 9 types of substance addictions. This is, again, pertaining to substance addictions. There's different kinds of addictions, mm-hmm. right? But yeah, the DSM acknowledges that. But with the DSM-5, majority of like mental disorders or whatever If your symptoms are as a result of substance use, like majority of the times you don't have that mental disorder, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's not, just to clarify, so yeah. Would that be then, so it's not, oh, okay, sorry, I just went through like a whole thought process in my head. So it's more like that substance or whatever is inducing the behavior, but it's not something that you intrinsically have. Okay. Yeah,
like if you have a major depressive disorder, let's say you're taking a drug that basically gives the symptoms of being depressed and like all the other symptoms. Mm-hmm. So if you can attribute those symptoms to a substance, some substance, then you can't really diagnose that person with that disorder.
Oh.
That's why like this DSM-5 actually has substance use disorder as a separate section.
Oh. So wait, sorry if you like keep diving into this, but now I have more questions. Yeah. So then what about something like, is that for everything? So what if you have like schizophrenic tendencies? So even then it wouldn't be that you have schizophrenia, it's you having like symptoms of it that's attributed to like whatever substance abuse that you're experiencing.
Yeah. Like if you're taking drugs that give you hallucinations, you can't say you're like schizophrenic. It's more that substance is giving it. So anything like a lot of the DSM-5s, of like if you're able to read it or whatever, there's like a section. Like if you can attribute it to substance use or substance use disorder, then like everything is basically invalid.
Okay. I feel like that would be such an interesting episode because there's so much is controversy the right word? I don't know. But like the way that people like around the DSM. So to like contextualize it, the DSM, do you want to explain what it is?
That's a good definition. It's just like, it's just a criteria. Basically, it's consists of a criteria of like a list of how, not physicians, but healthcare professionals can use in order to diagnose an individual with a certain disorder. Again, the DSM-5 is something that's, like you say, it's kind of controversial in the sense that like there's not, it has strict criteria, but it's up to the healthcare professionals like discretion in diagnosing the person.
So sometimes one physician or healthcare professional might say that you have this sort of disorder, but then another one might say, well, maybe you don't, just because it's like the way that things are listed in the DSM-5. Yeah. I think that's the most recent one, right? The DSM-5?
DSM-5, yeah. It's really up to like, it's, like, if you look at the DSM-5, you're like, oh, wow, like, pretty strict criteria. Like, yeah, but there's the issue of, like, some things might overlap. Mm-hmm. Like, taking my test, I was like, it's kind of hard. The symptoms overlap and stuff. But, yeah, that's just a little spiel on the DSM-5.
Yeah, that was a bit off topic, sorry. But
no.
Conversation, though.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, like, it's a medical disease. Addiction is. Sorry. But, basically, neuroscience has allowed us to understand how the brain changes, again, to the exposure of substance use. So the brain has this thing called the mesolimbic pathways that connects the brainstem through the peripheral nervous system, which plays a big role in the brain's reward system. And the reward system that plays an even bigger role in addiction and just how the dependency is created. And why, like, even again, individuals in an environment where they're not taking drugs can stimulate tolerance and all that fun stuff. Not fun stuff, I'm sorry.
Wait, can you repeat that last sentence again that you were saying about the stimulating tolerance? I think I had a question, but it just slipped my mind.
Well, like, okay, so, like, if you're in an environment, like, you're not taking the drug, right? But if you're in an environment where you would normally take that drug, like, your brain kind of kicks in and it's like,
oh, okay.
The symptoms are the same, like high or whatever you would have in order to that the addiction, which kind of plays a big role in tolerance to addiction. I mean, to like, not just addiction, but substances.
Gotcha. Okay.
But yeah, so neuroscience, specifically neuroscience, defines reward as an experience that produces pleasure or relief from discomfort. So there are neurotransmitters such as dopamine and beta endorphins that assist in the connection to the reward system in the brain. However, in individuals with addiction, research has shown that the pathway, so the mesolimbic pathway, which is involved in eating, sleeping, and sex, can be hijacked by addiction, which results in the reward pathway becoming dependent on the substance or the behavior rather than the neurotransmitter in your brain. So basically, like, it explains why people with addictions might not, like, a loss of appetite or an increase in appetite, being, like, super tired, or what's the opposite of being super tired? I don't know the opposite.
Energetic?
Energetic, okay. Sorry, I only know being tired. Or, like, having, like, there's sex addictions too, right? So, like, having, let's say higher needs, or, like,
or, like, an affinity for it,
yes,
I guess?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Desire, whatever?
Yeah, that's better. So, basically, as a result of the pathway being hijacked, and, like, addicts can become trapped in the cycle of drug acquisition and constant reward delivery because, again, like, you take the drug, they're getting that relief, they're getting that pleasure, and they take the drug again so they can feel that feeling again. Neuroscience has also demonstrated that adolescents are more susceptible to addiction than adults because of, like, incomplete brain regions such as the prefrontal cortex that I feel like a lot of you might be here, like, hearing about, which can play, again, a big role in the susceptibility. I just want to say, like with weed and stuff, right? Like, there's research that has shown that high consumption rates or high frequency rates of, like, ingesting weed before the age of 25 can result in, like, mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of also because your prefrontal cortex does not develop until the age of 25. Anyways, so that's just, like, what that just shows how the brain reacts to addiction and, like, that reason why we, again, attribute it to a medical disease rather than a behavioral disorder, because there's actually changes in your physiology, in the structures of your brain as a result. A really cool part, or a really interesting part, I would say, is the genetic component of addiction. So there's actually a very high genetic component attributed to addiction. Research has shown that addiction has a significant genetic component with an estimated 40 to 60% of addiction susceptibility attributed solely to genetic factors. So it's the whole idea of, like, heritability, like, again, addiction probably running in your family. Not necessarily saying that if you have a family member that is an addiction that you will have it. There's actually this cool model called diathesis stress model, where like, variety of individuals, we have different genetic components for different diseases. And it's like, okay, if you were to take a cup and imagine one individual has a line halfway through, like, and another individual has a line, like, the genetic component is filled a quarter way through. If you were to experience stress that fills that cup past, like, the, say, the top, then you will develop the disorder. But with the individual that has, like, the quarter amount, let's say you experience the same amount of stress as the other individual, you won't develop the disorder. But again, if the person with the smaller genetic disposition was able to have experience more stress in their life than the person with a higher genetic disposition, they're more likely to develop addiction than the other person. Does that make sense? I feel
No, you're good.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, so basically, like, it's, again, like, we all have a genetic disposition, and that might explain why more other people are more susceptible to addiction, but it's not a definite answer in that you will develop the disorder. But if you're wondering, like, you know, how does Danuni know this? Wow, what an Einstein. There's actually twin studies that have demonstrated that the genetic factors play a role in the heritability of addiction. So in addition, like, linkage mapping and genome-wide association studies have identified
GWAS
have identified candidate genes for addiction-related phenotypes. Some cool findings, because there's, like...
Wait, real quick.
Yeah.
Sorry, you said a lot of big words there. Do you mind, like, just so we can, I don't know,
would
for
you
the
like
audience.
Explain
just
what GWAS is, Sanya?
GWAS, or Genome-Wide Association Studies, I feel like it's a little self-explanatory. But for those of you who have never heard the term, that is absolutely okay. It is a weird one. Basically, it's where scientists look at the entire genome of an organism in order to map out like specific details of it. So all like if you want to do it in a human, then you would do a genome-wide association study in a human genome, and you would be able to map out like all the little details that are within it.
Yeah, so basically it's like if you're looking for a gene to be correlated with a certain disorder.
Sorry, I made a weird slurp sound.
If you wanted to, like, to see if a gene correlates with a certain disorder or something, you would take a bunch of people, map their genes, and then see their prevalence or, like, yeah, the prevalence of that disorder amongst individuals.
I forgot that detail of it. You're right. Basically, yeah, if they all meet, or not all, but if, like, certain genes, like you were saying, meet a certain threshold.
Yeah.
In similarity to whatever, if that gene passes that like benchmark for what would be an attributing factor to whatever like disease or condition that you're looking for, then it would be like linked to that. Then you could say that chromosome or that whatever is linked to that disease.
Yeah. So basically in a like in
or disorder.
Yes, basically in the context of like addiction, there's actually like there have been candidate genes that have been identified for various addiction related phenotypes. So there's a lot. There's, if you look it up, you'll find so many different genes for so many, not for so many, for different, for various types of addictions. There's things that are still in the progress, some that have been well established, just very, quite various amount. Some notable findings include the variants in the I'm gonna say GABBR2.
GABA? Oh no, wait, there is no A. Yeah, no. Sorry, my mistake.
The GABBR2, which encodes for the GABA subunit B receptor, subunit 2, and the linkage of chromosome 9 is to be linked with nicotine addiction. Another finding includes GABRA2 as a potential susceptibility factor and confirmed risk locus for alcohol addiction. But again, there's so many other candidate genes that support the whole significant genetic component to addiction.
Real quick, do you want to say what locus is? Because you said that word, locus.
Locus is, I think the best analogy was, it's a postal code. It's like the postal code. So we all have our own addresses, right?
Mm-hmm.
But your neighborhood, it's that, that's like the postal code, yeah. And that's the best way. I don't want to get
on a gene.
On a gene, yes.
Yeah.
On a gene. Or on a chromosome.
Or a chromosome, sorry.
On a chromosome.
Yeah.
We love science. So, as we know, addiction is a serious disease that not only has deleterious functions, but can have social impacts on individual and their loved ones. So, there's, of course, we know there's an abundance of research on addiction, but there are actually few effective treatments present. So we know we can identify genes, we can note the different brain structures and stuff, but the treatments, there's not many. There's not, I guess, there's a lot of novel ones, but not, sorry, I'm breathing. I got to breathe. But there are not a lot of effective ones, I can say. Current interventions have shown to be effective in rather like actually reducing the intensity of the withdrawal symptoms and the likelihood of use or relapse rather than eliminating the addiction as a whole, if that makes sense. These interventions typically block the effects of the drug. So we're talking mainly in the context of substances. Okay, medications such as naltrexone can act as an antagonist at postsynaptic receptors. These are usually used to block the synaptic transmission. For alcohol addictions, again, another big word, disulfiram is used to inhibit acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, which results in the accumulation of acetaldehyde to induce nausea, vomiting, headaches, which when it interacts with alcohol.
Question.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm, is that in the liver?
What is?
This whole process. Cause I remember sorry, it was just like random off topic, but I remember reading something about that, like the way that, never mind. That, does that occur in the liver?
No, yeah, because I think there's acetaldehyde dehydrogenase in your stomach. So, like, it's, there's a part that it helps break down alcohol. So, when you take that and it inhibits it, like, I think it does break down alcohol, but it induces, like, the symptoms, like I said, nausea, vomiting, just makes you feel like trash. It's basically like, you know, when you drink a bunch of alcohol, you just want to vomit, like, that's what it's doing, even if it's like a small amount of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry, yeah, that was like an off question. I just remember that, like going back to the thing that you were saying about alcohol, mm-hmm. like as it's being processed in your liver, like one of the toxic chemicals, whatever you want to call it, is that. So I was just trying to think, like, that. Make the connection about where. Okay, sorry.
Continue. We're scientists. But yeah, basically.
Oh, it literally says for alcohol addiction. No wonder it's. Sorry, for some reason I was like, is she talking about a different substance? You literally said for alcohol addiction. Oh no, my God.
It is for the alcohol, for the vodka. For
That's why. Okay. Sorry. Continue. I had a brain fart.
It just kind of shows how there's, again, like I mentioned before, there's an abundance of research that can acknowledge that addiction is a medical disease and how there's changes in the brain and how it has a huge genetic component, but there's very few effective treatments. And science is definitely, researchers and scientists are definitely constantly coming up with new ways to treat these addictions. Also in identifying different candidate genes in identifying like susceptibility to certain addictions.
Cool.
That is my part.
If just as like a general conversation question here, why do you think that like there hasn't been a cure for addiction? Like, what do you think, what makes it so difficult?
I think, okay, so there's this whole debate on like, is addiction really an illness or is it a choice, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of scientists too that like argue that addiction is a choice, right? It's what you put in your body, what you choose to do is mm-hmm. your own thing. And they don't really acknowledge it as an illness, like other things like having a heart attack or something, right? Like everyone, I guess you can say is on the same page of saying, yeah, heart attack is an illness and we will all probably congregate together and find a cure. So maybe there's just like, people are too busy in deciding for themselves if addiction is a disease or not. Even though it's been defined as an addiction, as a disease, mm-hmm. that not many people have taken their time to find a cure for it or find suitable treatments.
That's fair. And I feel like just another element of that, like aside from like society's view of what addiction is, mm-hmm. like the brain is so complex and multifaceted.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know much about neuroscience. My knowledge is very minimal in comparison to you or literally anyone else.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like it's just one of those things. Like there's so many mechanisms involved with it. Like, I just don't know.
No, that's fair. Like there's certain things that we can't explain solely based on neuroscience, mm-hmm. right? Like even the whole genetic component part, right? Not many people would have known that it's a heritable disease, not heritable disease, retract that completely, that it has a certain genetic component to it.
Yeah, like you could have like a predisposition to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see where you're going, yeah.
I was going to say, it's not heritable at all. God. What were we talking about?
Just like, why do you think it's so hard to address addiction? Yeah. Like, why hasn't it been addressed or cured?
Yeah. It's, again, like, even though we've known about addiction for a while, it's still, there's constantly changing information in regards to addiction. Like, again, the different genes and the risk loci, mm-hmm. it's constantly changing. There's mm-hmm. constantly new things being identified that it's so hard to create interventions and treatments to be like, let's target this gene, let's target this chromosome and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's just like medicine in general. The body is complex, and sometimes it's a pain in the ass to figure it out.
I think that's a great way to end it.
Very succinct, very, but not wrong.
Not wrong.
Well, anyways, but yeah, thank you everyone for joining us on this week's episode of Baker Bros.
Until next time.